that you can set for yourself. So consider it another option, like meditation. Use the same music or music that's good for you and try it out. See what it's like.
One thing about meditation music like this, although a lot of real meditators don't like the music at all, is that it takes away all that kind of background noise. It gives your own mind a chance to think about something else. And this particular tape is 30 minutes of constant kind of music without having highs and lows, so you don't get kind of energized by it. You don't get interrupted by the end of songs and the beginning of songs. You don't get interrupted by words, which is often a problem. Classical music will often work just as well, long pieces, if they're gentle, if you're used to it. Auto harps are marvelous things. I think they're very mystical, soft.
Another thing I think is very important is to be able to share intimacy and affection with people and not have it always sort of going towards sexual intimacy. So when there's a lot of counseling of people who are having problems with their relationships, a lot of times it's like they're never touching and all of a sudden they expect to be touching way up here. And some of the unfoldment type exercises are very gentle and very nice ways of relating to people, and it takes out some of the sting. If you decide that you're going to do something like this and that's what it's going to be, if you can accept that kind of affection or loving or sensuousness and just enjoy just that, that's a really good thing to be able to accept.
Anything else on Elmer's talk? Sort of touched on some of those issues just now. Making sure that you have, yes, please.
I know for me, I was just laughing at myself this morning because yesterday I was sitting in here thinking that I was pretty righteous because I have a fairly open mind about, I mean, I'm not saying that I think it should be rampant or anything, but I like Elmer's point of view. I mean, you know, how he didn't make it black and white, but yet, and I was sitting around looking at everyone's face in the room after the talk I'd done. Yeah, look at them. They're so stressed out because they demand a black and white answer. They need it, you know. And then, I'm serious. This is so funny because I was sitting here thinking today, and I was thinking, boy, you were looking for a pretty black and white answer yourself, weren't you, in an open way. I mean, even though I still felt that I was open or whatever to other ideas, I was still wanting to say, yeah, but so you're open, but still, give me just a little, some guidelines. You know what I mean?
Within open guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, we're open, but we still want some loose guidelines. You know?
A little bit great.
I thought it was really because it shattered everything that you think you have all planned out and all set in your head. I know how to handle this. It's all
mapped out now.
Yeah, I really liked it. I don't know, it seems like all the rules or everything we have was all just down basic to, do you believe that it's life-enriching to you or to other people? And if you do, if you hurt someone, you're not trying to do that. You're trying to make it life-enriching. And that, I mean, there's an extent, I think, but that, I don't know, it seems so simple. It seems so neat to me. And, yeah, what?
I was thinking, I thought it sounded so simple, and then I started thinking about it, and... Wow. it sounds so beautifully simple almost. And then I got to thinking about it, and it wasn't. I tried to apply it to my own situations that I've been in, and I had to think. I had to think to myself again.
Oh, shoot.
Why does he demand things of me?
It shifts the responsibility. I mean, I seriously yesterday all day and even now a little bit felt like a boulder was being, you know, set on me and crushing me, because it's just responsibility. Now we no longer have, I mean, according to his talk, I still don't know how much of it I accept and how much not. But with that kind of responsibility, we no longer have either the cage to hide in of not doing it, or if we do it, then not having anyone to blame. Like before, if we did it, we could say, well, it's a sin. If it's a sin, the devil made me do it. And it's over. seriously, sometimes it can get down to that. And now, it's yourself who has the responsibility of making those decisions, yourself that has to face up to it, and that's a really, a real heavy burden. And I'm still not, you know, I haven't worked through what he said.
Choices.
Haven't decided which parts I'm going to accept and which not.
Annette?
I just want to say that yesterday when Elmer was talking, it was like taking a boulder off of me almost, in a sense, because I'd always felt so frustrated. And it was another way to look at it, and it made sense and everything, and I just thought, all right, praise the Lord, this is great. And then all of a sudden I bumped into Bob. And Bob
started, which Bob?
Baker.
Bob Baker.
And he does a lot of, like, he calls it premarital working or something like that. He doesn't like to call it counseling because it gives people...
workshops or something?
Yeah. He calls it that because he doesn't want people to think pathological stuff, you know? And it was really, really helpful when he was showing me this diagram and stuff. Because at first, when I came out of Elmer's talk, I was thinking, boy, this is great. You know, all I have to do is just make sure it's life-enriching and that I'm not using the other person and it's because I really care and all this. And then I started thinking, after Bob had started talking to me and showing me this diagram, that it's really not that easy to make sure that it's really for the other person. Once you start going, honey, it's like, you know, and that I'm really glad that I met Bob. And, you know, that's all I have to say.
Okay, let's recap. I'm not sure I quite understand what you're saying in that. What you're saying is that, yeah, it felt like at first Elmer was saying, yeah, do whatever you want as long as it feels good. And then what Bob was saying is...
not feels good, though, but life-enriching for
okay.
the other person.
Okay.
Not the self.
He didn't
focus.
Say life-enriching for the other person, actually. What he said was that it was life-enriching. But anyway, what you were saying is that in one way, Elmer was sort of freeing you up that within a certain context anything goes. And what Bob was saying is you got to be a lot more careful figuring out what that context is. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
Actually, that's what Elmer said, too.
But it grabbed me another way, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the message to that, much like the message to the movie that we saw last night, was that oftentimes what we see is what we want to see. And I think what we need to be real careful about what we are wanting to see and why. And that's probably what Bob was talking about.
You're so deep.
Yeah, right. Just like Chauncey Gardner, a deep guy. But anyway, I thought that movie was very apropos to the class, which is why the book was so apropos, because it talks about... how we project what we want, and sometimes that works for us, and sometimes it gets us into a lot of trouble. Anyway, Marty.
Yeah, it was just that life-enriching speech was really hit me pretty hard because I've had some relationships, I don't know if they're relationships, but just, you know, meeting girls and stuff and going out with them, hanging out. And I was trying to, like, before I came here, I met a girl just a few days before, like New Year's Eve party and so forth. I was going, boy, was that like enriching? Well, New Year's Eve it wasn't. I was just having fun for myself, kind of greedy. Then I met her again, and we talked more and danced and hung out and went out to dinner and stuff. And I was going, huh, that felt good. I felt really a lot more enriched by, you know, going out like that. And then I was going, was she enriched by the experience, you know? And I was questioning all these times I've been out with people and how I felt about the experiences and if they were good or were they just something I wanted to do for myself to prove something or do something, you know, that I thought was good for me but wasn't really good for me because I was actually thinking about enriching someone else's life and my life. So now all these questions are popping up on, and like I was talking to Todd, I was like, I'm pretty sure it was life enriching. I mean, I feel it's pretty good, you know, but wasn't, you know, feel about that now.
I don't know, something I've been thinking about is that a lot of times I think almost too far ahead. It's almost like, well, is this guy, I almost like make up my mind what I think is going to hurt the other person. And it's not my trip. I mean, that the other person, maybe it's not going to, maybe they're going to enjoy it, maybe they're going to get something out of it, maybe they're going to tell me if what I'm going to do is going to hurt them. That I'm sitting here making judgments way ahead of time instead of just living there. So that's something.
What did Elmer say about hurt and pain? can, what he said about it. Well, he was talking about his own relationship and his own growth.
He said, he essentially said that hurt and pain aren't bad, and like his marriage was marvelous, but it was a struggle. It was joyous, but it was, and that those hurts and pains weren't necessarily bad. They were part of what helped there be joys too.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we think about oftentimes is that we're afraid that we're going to hurt somebody else. And so we want to shield them, protect them, shield us, protect us. And in the process, what we do is we shield us from experiencing, which is what we learn from, which is how we develop a capacity to live our lives however we choose to live them. And like my illusion of the bicycle about falling off and hurting yourself, we forget the fact that it really hurt when we skinned our knee. All we remember is that now we ride a bicycle. And I think it's real important to realize that learning hurts. Learning costs. And you cannot learn by trying to not hurt, or you can responsibly and honestly experience it. And the honesty part is the hardest one. I mean, you can easily say, yeah, right, this is a lot of fun. I guess fun means it's enriching, sort of, in a way. But on the other hand, if you're real honest with yourself, you can sort of see what it's all about. You can't look at yourself unless you look at yourself through the lens of experience, but you can't look at the lens of experience unless you're also looking at yourself. So it's a kind of two-way street in that sense. I also feel, too, that one of the things Elmer said is that who hurts somebody else, most of the time, a person gets themselves hurt. They are not hurt by another person. And I think that was a real important part of it, which doesn't mean that an experience you have with another person doesn't hurt you. It doesn't mean that another person may, in fact, even treat you cruelly. But you are a willing participant in that. And to accept your responsibility for that is part of the thing that Elmer talked about, too. Accepting responsibility, seeing your role in it. Don't seeing yourself as the victim. Don't see yourself as the person who is following somebody else's rules. You are there for your own needs, your own reasons. And sometimes you hurt someone. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you get hurt. Kate, you wanted to say something about the little map here?
Yeah, I think many of us are on a spiritual journey. And I think this map of a spiritual journey, when you look down and compare, say, what Kai was saying, he's under the searching section. He's checking, instead of serving his own needs and experiences, he's moving into the own section. When you go down to the first little dash, it says authority is fully internalized and critically examined. He's checking it out with other people. He's trying to decide which way to go based on not only himself but the other person and the other person's needs.
Actually, I think Kai's more in the searching area. Authority still exists, mm-hmm. but must be confronted within.
Confirmed.
And in that sense, the struggle that a lot of us are about saying, what is authority? Is it outside? Is it inside? What's this all about? Who am I? Where does it all fit in? By the time authority is fully internalized and critically examined, I think we're at a different point. But I think you're right. This is a very, very powerful document. I really would recommend those of you who haven't looked at it very closely to not only look at it again, but keep it around. So I don't think it's just the journey of young adults. I think it's a journey that's repeated cyclically throughout. I mean, I think in some ways I'm in owned, in some ways I'm in searching again.
Mm-hmm.
That's about.
Mm-hmm. You dip back and forth. And what Marty was saying, how he had changed, I think it's somewhere in searching and owned as well. A lot of you have heard people say, well, back in the affiliative, I know what I believe, but I can't tell you what it is, or I can't tell you why it is. And the law-oriented religion. And then if you zip over on the totally opposite side, you have a very clear belief system. You can express it, and what do they mean when they say gospel-oriented compared to law-oriented? What's the difference in terms of...
Law-oriented is you do the things you do because that's what you're supposed to do, that's what it says to do and not to do. Gospel-oriented, you're freed up to do the things. You have freedom to do what you want, and through that freedom, you make the right choices.
It's like Chris was talking about, it's between the church and God, there's a difference there.
Also, we were talking about codependence and interdependence. If you look down on how you view authority, you can do something just because you're nice or good, or you can do something in terms of counter-dependence because you're exactly the opposite of what people tell you to do, which is another way of confirming authority, because you're rebelling just the opposite way. Or you can go into being dependent on others without losing what you believe in, that interdependence. What we were talking about is intimacy and independence in terms of typical challenges. If you're in the own section, you're really developing your own integrity and clarifying your purpose. Well, you can't clarify your purpose until you deal with some of the earlier issues. Patterns of support. I think you've got a lot of people who go belong to a community or go to church or belong to a certain subgroup, and they're real interested in being wanted or having others be wanted. And that's part of it. But the other part is being challenged and asking questions and personalizing it, moving into the so-called promised land section, where you're really doing some critical thinking and taking on responsibilities for sharing with others in a very open-ended fashion. I think in some ways, teaching parenting in adulthood is a real beautiful journey. It's maybe not the promised land, as you might interpret it. It's a lot of hard work, but it's a nice place to be and get there. Other comments on the sheet?
It isn't quite yet 10:15, so I want to wait a little bit. Yes.
Hi.
On the own part, or on the promised land part, down across patterns from support, it says a community of like-minded people. What does that mean? Does that mean?
What do you think that means, Todd?
Maybe wherever you're living in, you have a certain web of people that you respect and believe with and can really talk with about what you're thinking and stuff. But I don't know, so for some reason though, when I first struck it, it was like, you know, reminding me of something like this or something, or even if these aren't, I don't know, of the most places I don't think of as people, are communities of like-minded people. I don't know, maybe I'm doing it too literally.
What about, okay, forget about the sense of the little neighborhood you live in, or maybe your entire wing, okay, people at school. But think of the close-knit group, maybe those few couple people that you really relate with, maybe you have similar views, maybe you don't. I mean, I'm used to having different groups of friends, but I know there are some friends that I associate in another way, that we believe a lot of our faith is really similar, a lot of our views on different moral issues. And we go to each other discussing that, and we have dilemmas or whatever.
It just feels to me, Tom, like when you know yourself so much, it doesn't matter if
yeah.
people are like-minded, that you can accept them as on their own, and you can be with them, and they don't have to be like-minded at all.
Okay, would you like to be in a group of people who were extremely closed and extremely radical in their beliefs, left or right, that didn't want to have anything to do with feelings or touching or anything like that? You wouldn't care what their beliefs were, but you would care about the kind of content and style about how they went about their beliefs. So I think maybe that's more like what they're talking about.
Yeah, let's say you're in a community where everyone's willing to risk, if that's your desire, then those would be like-minded people. You're not necessarily closing yourself off because they all believe in ABC, but they all have a lifestyle that's a certain way.
This last summer, I visited a community, a spiritual community in northern Scotland called Findhorn. It doesn't have a spiritual dogma. There are people from all beliefs, Sufis and Christians and Muslims and all kinds, pagans. But the thing that they base themselves in is the idea of being openness and having this kind of spiritual center. And they are from all over the world. Everyone from speaking a million different languages. So it was very diverse, but nonetheless it was a community that was oriented in a kind of way that gave us a space to be able to communicate our diversity. One thing I wanted to add before we break, which is something that I brought up, I think, to a couple people independently, but Elmer and I only talked about afterward, is that when thinking about the Bible as a guide, sort of looking at the specific things in there, is that oftentimes we forget that the Bible is a political document. is not just a spiritual document. And the history of the Bible is an important thing to realize, which is there are many sections of it that were expurgated. There were many parts of it that were translated and redefined long before King James finally came up with his version of it. And so consequently, I think what Elmer was saying about finding your truth in it is a real important one. I've mentioned this book to several people, but there's a book called the Gnostic Chronicles, which are books of the New Testament that were discovered somewhere in, I think it was Morocco or Syria, I don't remember where it was. The Gnostics were a group of early Christians who were severely repressed by the Church of Rome. The documents that they had were expurgated from the Testament and were burned or destroyed. And several of them have come down to us because they were hidden in caves and jars, much like the Dead Sea Scrolls were. And they're a very interesting view of Christ and Christianity, including that there were women in the group of disciples, as well as empowering a personal response to religion independent of the church. And when we think back of what Roman history was and what the church was when Rome fell, we realize that what the whole church was at that time was more of a restructuring of power, not a restructuring of spirit. And the Gnostic Chronicles document that fairly well. It's a fascinating book to kind of develop a perspective on what those spiritual teachings are. I recommend those of you who are thinking about all that should pick up that book and read it.
I also felt, just personally, that it was interesting to hear Elmer say there were a lot of mistakes in terms of the way sex was handled, but also how women were handled. And I think that's another whole subject area that hasn't been addressed here.
Yeah, I think we'll probably be able to talk about some of that when we finish up with Narcissus and Goldman. One quick question, who has yet to finish the book? One, two, three,
four.
Five. Everyone else is pretty much, how close are you guys to finishing?
Very close.
Okay, we may be forced to discuss the end of the book anyway, but maybe what I ought to do this, when we first come back is to show some slides, because we've talked about the inner outer, but we haven't dealt with it very much. And these slides may sort of loosen it up a little bit and sort of bring some of that out. So let's take our break and tell what our posture is going to be in response to that possible confrontation. To close our eyes and experience life in a blind sort of way is a very threatening thing for us to do, very difficult. Imagine what it's like for people who really have lost their sight. A very interesting sort of way of going through it. But speaking of vision and sight, what I want to show you now are portraits. Portraits as expression. So what I'm going to go through are just a series of portraits. First, I think, of women, and then of men. Maybe first of men, and then of women. I don't really remember. And then a small group of them that are men and women. Now, as we're looking at these, I don't want us to try and figure out whether it's good art or bad art. What I want us to do is just experience what information we're getting about these people, what it is we feel about it. So try and suspend your judgment if you can, and just try and experience what you see. What I would like to do is go through them all very quickly first, and then kind of back up and look at them again. Yeah. I'll keep going through them again.
There's it's cold, too. She doesn't look like she's allowed to be open. Like, the clothes are soft.
Referring to this one here.
Yeah. Her clothes are soft, but she looks... I don't know.
Look at the high lace collar and the long lace sleeves. I mean, it's like...
Like she's, yeah, like she's closed in, but she's trying to get out. I don't know.
Look at her hands on her armrest. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, I see tension there maybe.
What about this one?
Empty inside. Hollow eyes.
Mask-like kind of face you're referring to and stuff. It's hard for me to hear with a machine on, so you can speak loudly.
Yeah.
We're having I think looking at these slides again, there is something in general that's communicated here that is sort of interesting. The majority of these are painted by men, in fact. The slide library at PLU is distinctly lacking in women artists.
The circle.
So what are we seeing about women, do you think?
Well,
hurt somehow. I mean, not smiling, not really happy. There's something about that. A lot of emotion coming in.
Say, speak up, everyone. I can't hear you. What did you say, Annette?
Maybe lonely inside, you know.
Didn't you also say vulnerable? Didn't I hear you say that?
I don't know. I'm
yeah, I think you said that.
Oh, okay. Who's
oh,
that, Laura?
A childlike quality.
Super reminded.
Who's that?
What, I don't remember the artist of this particular song.
I like that.
What kind of roles do we see portrayed that women play?
Subservient.
Excuse me?
Subservient or motherly, kind of like always needing to be cared for.
Caretakers.
Oh, no.
Caregivers.
I want to hear kind of triumph.
Oh. Survivors. The mistress.
So we see women as being sexual. We see women as being feminine. We see women as being mothers. We see women as being objects. We see an emphasis on large circles in their chest.
Please, Lori.
What about these women?
They all look like they, when they were younger, they look like they got into trouble.
There's something in their smell that's kind of like, yeah. This particular piece is called Daughters of the American Revolution. I'm sure they don't have Kahlua in their coffee. This is interesting.
The cover one sticks out.
Tradition.
A delicate hand, almost sort of like the head of a crane or something, kind of poking up there.
Who's that character in 2001 who has that hand that reaches out? Or is it 2001?
Al?
No? The one that gets the, it's not M&M's.
Oh, that's not 2001.
E.T., yeah, E.T. hands. Sorry. It's not 2001.
What about these women in comparison? What can you say about this painting? Do they look like they're comfortable being where they are?
It's like college dorm.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
What are their postures betrayed?
Sex.
I can't hear what you're saying.
Sex.
Or subservience.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's real interesting that oftentimes when we see that a subservient role, there's a kind of part of us that thinks in sexual terms. That says something about how we view ourselves as sexual animals, especially as how we view women.
Oh, good grief. A deck of playing cards.
Actually, that's out of place.
Looks like she's discovering her own sexuality.
Self-examination.
That's real mysterious. That's always fascinated me, that one.
Balthus is a very peculiar painter. Remember that one we saw just before, the Matisse in the Circle? This is a one by Lichtenstein, which is a sort of using a poster of that one painting as a place to start another painting from. It's the difference in this and feel and that one and feel are rather explicit, but. I think you can probably sense it if you can't talk about it, so I don't want to move on. And of course, this is a very famous Andy Warhol portrait of Marilyn Monroe. So now let's see if we can figure out what we've seen about women, as manifest in these images, of course. See if someone can kind of run through them. Anybody?
Vulnerability, sexuality, femininity, subservience,
vulnerability, okay. Nurturance.
Self-discovery, tighter.
Caring. Mother figures.
Masks.
Yeah.
And also something to be worshipped. It's a sense of worship.
Yeah, that's right. Some of them have that sense of sort of admiring from a distance.
Yeah.
feeling. Okay, let's take a look at some men. In the sense of kind of distance about them.
Well, no, they just looked. Much they of just looked like they were like portraits of village idiots. A lot of them. I mean, they just had kind of dumb expression.
Okay. What else are we seeing about them?
Kind of like when I looked at some of the men, you could tell what they do for a living. Or something.
Their profession.
Looks like they've had a hard life.
Not warm.
Dejected.
No kids.
Well, that cat is super kids.
That one's really tortured.
So you're sitting in a sauna.
And I think Annette said sinister when she saw this one. So what is this telling us about not only what we may think about men now, but what the artists themselves are saying, consciously or otherwise?
There's no naked body stuff. They're not voluptuous.
It's a profession.
There, whoops, went the wrong way. I don't like this painting particularly.
Now who's that?
Oh, it's just nice expression. So brilliant.
And that looks
not vulnerable, they're
close. Just kind of close.
One of my favorite pieces. Max Beckman is one of my favorite artists.
Oh, I'd hate to meet him in a dark corner.
I'd hate to meet him in a light corner.
Yeah.
In a corner.
Real interesting portrait of Lenin. I'd throw that one in. As long as we saw all those manifestations of Lenin on the piano by Dali, I thought we might as well have another. Actually a pretty horrible painting. So men are, they're distant, cold, angry, sinister, professional. What else?
This is like, I mean, you can see it is from the depression and sort of a loss of their mask. They look hurt, they look vulnerable to me in this picture, but not the other ones.
Yeah, I'm really disturbed that they're not
there
people smile. Maybe it's just a choice.
Maybe that's because. No, a lot of these are random chosen. Some of them I chose specifically. Most of them are rather random. Looking at the slide library, I said, "Oh, is that a man? Okay, take it." I didn't think very much about some of them. This one I chose particularly.
It's a shrine.
Okay, let's look at men and women. I just have a few. Well, no, I'm sorry. There are a few more men here. Where am I? Well, I don't know what I'm doing now. Yeah, a few more minutes.
Oh, God. What a painter.
Yeah, I think Christine was saying that it looks almost African. And what is it, that sort of African mask? Is that what you were thinking of?
Well, I thought it was like more the paint
on. The paint?
Like the clay they put on their faces and stuff?
But his eyes do.
In his nose.
His nose.
Large nose.
That's the one I think I wanted to end with. Since I ended with Marilyn Monroe, I thought I'd end with the self-portrait of Chuck Close. This particular piece isn't etching, but it is something like 8 feet by 6 feet. He had a special press built just so that he could do this. Could you imagine having this face that large in your home?
Is that a photograph or a...
Etching is a drawing that's done on a metal plate. And it's a rather elaborate process that I could explain if you're really interested, but I don't want to take the time now.
So it's not
but
a photo?
It's not a photo. No, he did his drawing from a photo, but it's not a photo. Okay. Let's take these one at a time. Okay, what's going on here? What do we think's going on here?
I thought at first it was a dad and his little girl, and then I decided it couldn't be.
Why? Because
of where his hand is at. Mm-hmm. I thought
just a better with him. Yeah, I mean a real little girl.
I don't know. There's just something about her that isn't
her
there.
Her face.
At all.
She doesn't want to be in a picture.
What if he's holding her back from something?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I just
she
you want something?
But wait, let's talk about this a little bit. What, keep talking, Meg. Why else do you think it doesn't seem right for a father and a daughter? Anyone want to help her out?
The faces.
Faces are an indifference. Like a man's face seems indifferent to the whole thing. He's just patiently waiting for the session to be over, whatever the little girl looks like she's.
Go ahead, Christine.
Two things that really, I don't know if they're really relevant, but the shoes of the girl, her feet are so tiny. I mean, they're not even in proportion to the rest of her body. And also her dress. The first thing I thought of was an inmate in a jail prison.
Okay, let's continue talking about this.
Well, she's kind of pulling away from
yeah.
it. Look at her arms.
Her arms too.
She's also holding on to it, too.
Yeah, she looks like she could fall, and she has a brace on her leg, and she needs to be supported.
One real important part of this that I think Meg is having a hard time talking about that we're not bringing to the fore here. There is a very sensual, probably even sexual quality between the way they are holding each other, the nature of that relationship. And it's something that we don't expect or want to even identify with the relationship of a father and a daughter. And I think that's what Meg was talking about when she said she didn't like the way his hand was on her chest or that the way their hands are touching. There's a quality about their relationship that is saying more than just what meets the eye. Balthus does that all the time. Balthus is the guy who did that adolescent woman looking at herself in the mirror. He's also the one who did those two strangely contorted women, one reading a book in a kind of kneeling position and the other with her head back on the couch. It's a part of the kind of psychological context of what he does. Let's talk about this one a bit. What do you feel when you see that? What's your first sense? Come on, just talk. Don't even think. What's your first sense? What's a word that comes to mind? Movement. What else?
Yeah, I first see as part of action. I mean, I don't think of it as just I see the whole dance, kind of. And so I don't think anything of it. The more I look at it, I see that it was, you know, that place with her dress up and her legs kind of apart. And I don't know, that thing is a photograph, maybe it does mean more.
Go ahead.
Might be crude, but the first thing I noticed was that he was looking down between her boobs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Looking right at
it. Let's keep talking about it. Christine, you had your hand up?
That's the same. I thought you were looking at the back, and he hasn't looked like, I'm going to get some.
Okay, how are they dressed? What's the difference between the way they're dressed?
He's formal.
Yeah, she's outlandish and wild, and she's reserved. Upright.
Okay, so she has a skirt that can be spread by moving and turning around. She has a bodice that is exposed. He is tied up with a real narrow collar, dressed in a penguin outfit. He is not open. He is not reserved. He is very reserved. He's very closed. He is the one who is standing straight and tall. He is the one who is almost controlling her by dangling her. She is the one who is spinning around in this passionate sort of spiral. What is this saying about how we view men and women? I don't think we need to elaborate, it's fairly clear. You've seen a couple of paintings by Modigliani, let's look at another one. What's our first response when we see this one?
Holding her down.
Yes, to sneeze.
I didn't hear you.
But he has to sneeze.
I don't know, I see love between them. Just that friend. Farmer's wife.
I think that she looks almost tame. Like she's in this role or whatever as his wife, and she's not happy, but she's got to make the best of it. Like, somebody please take the picture because.
Yeah, I'm gonna acquiesce.
I see tradition just because that. In the old photographs that you look at, oftentimes the woman is sitting and then the guy standing behind with one hand.
Notice how much of her is in the picture.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. So we all think a lot of different things about this one.
Yeah.
Yep. Looks like a mother proud of her son.
Well, I'm not so sure that that's a guy. My feeling is it could be a woman as well. The upper one is a mixture for me.
No, it happens to be a man.
It's a man, I know, but even so.
Yeah, but it does have kind of a feminine shape. I mean, you can see, think about a woman in English riding clothes.
Uh-huh.
They have the collars up and the...
Yeah, the mustache.
I know, but
yeah,
some
but
women have mustaches.
Woman has lighter skin and redder lips. And her eyes are slanted down and outside too.
Why do you suppose women always have lighter skin and redder lips?
The China doll effect.
Okay, but what is that all about?
Delicacy.
Being protected.
Sensuality. Bring them out to play with.
Well, Avisha, what are red lips about? Why do women put lipstick?
To draw
attention. Okay, why are they drawing attention? What is that all about?
Sexuality,
right. And why are men generally of darker skin? Because they're out laboring in the fields. So generally speaking, when we think about women, we think of milk white skin. When we think of men, we think of tall, dark, and handsome. I mean, all these sorts of images that are coming back, and we see them reflected back to us from the art that the cultures themselves produce. Now, that isn't, of course, universally true, but basically that is. Next time you're sort of making yourself look pretty, ladies, and you're sort of putting on your lipstick and your eye makeup and how you think you wouldn't want to be caught dead without it, ask yourself what it is you're really doing.
All right, thanks a lot.
Supporting Estee Lauder.
I disagree.
But then it's the guys that we do it for.
Don't do it for this guy.
Well, I mean, but a lot of...
I do it for myself.
I do it
for myself. Okay, I'm not saying you don't do it for yourself, but I'm asking you what you're really doing.
They're having fun, but they're denying that they're
being... This is not anyone in particular, at least that doesn't say on the slide. You know, I think you're all doing the wrong thing when you're saying, what is that? It is a piece of art. It is not anything more than a piece of art. And what I think you ought to do is respond to it, not worry about where her arms are or what are they standing in or isn't that a strange expression. I mean, just sort of experience it. What is it that communicates to you from that experience? What does it say to you?
Sex, the man carries the woman. I mean, he carries the burden and everything. To me, that's what I see.
Yeah, it's like,
it's really,
like riding a horse.
Really, their sense of fun is really twisted or weird.
I don't know. I see happiness, but then again, something makes me wonder, but are they really?
Yeah, it's surface happiness.
They look like they're not happy with each other. It looks like they're posing for the photograph almost. They're looking this way.
Also, they're really extreme. It's like they have to...
Neither of them really want to face each other, it seems. Just close their eyes and smile for the moment.
It's like they just pop out of a cave or something.
Isn't it strange that in a way they look like they're either having or trying to have fun, but where is the fun around them? What is it? They're at a beach, but are they confined in this tiny, strange pool? They are isolated and alienated in some odd sort of way. What is the nature of that experience that they're having? Those are the sort of really interesting messages that are implied in this piece. It's a painting by a sculptor, actually, but it's not a sculptor itself.
Oh, is this Grant Wood?
Yep. So was Daughters of the American Revolution. Famous painting called American Gothic, and what does this say?
So you want to marry our daughter.
Life is tough.
Well, there's a church behind them, isn't there?
No, that's
in a sense.
He focuses straight at us, and she can't look.
She's looking at
him.
And she's standing right by him.
Behind him.
She's
wearing an apron.
No,
wearing like working clothes.
And there's that trident protection device.
A symbol of authority.
her face is so non-wrinkled that hers is very wrinkled, so it gets back to the working in the fields and the harshness and the first hand.
Their beliefs and values really come out by the way they're standing, too.
But she's thinking, wait till I get you in the house.
I don't think so.
No. Go ahead and talk to her. Yeah. It's threatening. I'd rather not talk to either.
We've inherited some of our beliefs and values from these folks.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would. I'd almost rather talking to him because I could see her being very, judgmental.
I don't think he'd talk to you.
I think she looks really weak, like she's
You think she's scared? She looks sad.
Ask that question a little louder. Did everyone hear what Annette said?
Do you think she's scared at all? Inside, like?
Do you think he's scared?
He seems very hollow, very...
He seems very caring.
They're both very brittle to me.
Yeah.
He's ready to go cook some bread.
For all strength, I think he would be easily destroyed. For all the, it looks like when you look at it.
Jump in, Christine.
It seems interesting that his eyes are the first thing I look at, and the two things that are dominant to me are his eyes and her brooch. I don't know if that
If we looked at this painting upside down, I don't think you'd probably see the eyes right away, but you might see the brooch. Eyes are just usually what we look at when we see faces first. But, I understand. What was the sort of basic, one of the basic lessons of being there last night?
What
was one of the basic lessons of being there last night? What sort of happened?
We project what we want.
Right, we project what we want. What happened with old Chauncey is that everyone saw what they needed to see in him, and sometimes when you look at art, and especially when we have such diverse responses, what we may be seeing is something of ourselves. And not always, but it's sort of something to consider. I think I've got... Okay. Edward Hopper. Great American master. It's called Nighthawks.
Is that a comment on us here at Holden? Nighthawks.
What do you get from this piece? What was your first response? I mean, right away, trust that first response. Go ahead, Darren.
Why is there another guy in there? The third guy sitting at our...
Why is he?
The guy sitting at the counter.
Because he's alone in there now.
Yeah.
So why is he alone? I see mysteriousness. Mysterious light.
What's that?
Clean, quiet, silent. The whole street, there's no garbage room.
Well, I saw him before I saw the
camera.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I see the two colors predominated, the red and the black. Red again.
We're taking refuge here.
No time. There is no time.
The coffee urns are really predominant.
It's almost like looking into a fish tank.
Mm-hmm.
Just the glass.
Yeah, kind of glass. Yeah.
They're glassed off, too. They're walled into themselves, it looks like.
There's red and black in the picture, but the woman is wearing red and two men are
wearing
red. The man are in sort of black and white, and the woman is in red. Okay, we can continue talking, but what I'd like you to do before I go to the next photo is I want you to get your paper out, because I want you to do a free write on the next slide. Edward Hopper. I'm sorry, not Edward Hopper. David Hockney. This is Edward Hopper. David Hockney is a contemporary British artist, and one of the things that David Hockney was often talking about is what exists in relationships or what exists beyond the surface. So having said that, what I'd like you to do is writing as quickly as you can, thinking as absolutely little as possible, whether it's a narrative or whether it's one word at a time. I want you to write about the next piece, and I'm going to give you 5 minutes for it. So, is everybody ready?
Yeah.
The next painting is just the name of the people that that he does a portrait of. Let's talk a little bit about what you discovered as you were writing about this piece. some of the things that, go ahead.
It looks like it's in a waiting room, but it looks more, but it looks like it's supposed to look like that way. Like it's in an artist studio because everything can be folded up. The rug is small, can be rolled up, the chairs can be folded, there's rollers on the little cart, that everything can just be rolled away and left with the bank, blank green wall to do something else against.
I saw the vase and the lady as the same. It's like the flowers are barely allowed to bloom. They aren't allowed to be natural. They're just barely getting to poke out the top. And they're there, and they're put there because someone said, oh, isn't that nice to have flowers? And I see the lady's the same way. She's held back, and she's just barely allowed to show herself and to be pretty and to be a woman, but it's, she's just sort of there and kind of held there because it's a nice thing to have around.
Okay, Laurie and then Darren.
I saw the emotion that woman, like, as kind of self-conscious, and she's trying to get herself ready to see the doctor. And I saw, like, a gynecologist's office because she looks like she's postured, like, she's trying to make herself feel good before she goes in and stuff. And the guy doesn't really care about if he goes in to see her or not, you know, to see the doctor or something like that.
I saw the lady just kind of there waiting for the guy beckoning, whatever. I mean, just kind of like they're in their house and they're in there, they're really elderly, and he's just reading. And when he needs something, he'll just talk to her and she'll go do it. Then come back and sit where she's at when she.
Okay, Carrie, June, Meg, and Christine.
It looks like the woman's at a distance that she should not be heard from, but just seen.
The woman is made to look like she's an airhead, and the guy is more the thinker.
Okay.
The first thing I saw was total detachment, because even though there's no actual wall there, I see a wall between that lady and the man right where the chair and that table thing are. And I just thought that is total detachment.
Okay, Theo and then Tom. Kate, do you have your hand?
Me first. Well, I saw it after a little while. I saw it kind of as she has kind of a prisoner, and he's kind of a guard, kind of biding his time, watching over her. Then I started thinking of my feelings about that, and that she's kind of surrendered and kind of sitting there, contently surrendered. But then I started thinking, is he happy also being the prison guard? He's also trapped, being the guard that. You say that that he's also he's not happy either in that guard.
Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, I first thought that they seemed kind of almost peaceful, but then if you look at it, it seems like they're both nervous and tense. I mean, look at his legs. He's just on his toes, lifting up his legs, kind of hunched over. He's kind of nervous. Her one leg is kind of turned over on the other one, and she's kind of clenching her hands together. I mean, I can see that if there were motion, his legs would kind of be shaking, and she'd kind of be sitting there shaking a little bit. It just seems that there's some sort of tension, nervousness.
Okay, Kate, did you want to say something?
Yeah, they're isolated, they're waiting, they're alone, we don't know much about them. The woman is sort of on an island of her own, pleasing the viewer, because at least she's looking at us. The man is intent on something else. And it reminds me of memories, or what possessions we have in our mind, or also the kinds of relationships that some people have.
Okay, Michelle had her hand, Kai, and Darren, I think.
I also saw a doctor's office, and I saw her as very nervous about something, because at least for me, you'd never see me sitting like that, with my feet together, my knees together, my back, you know, sitting up straight, my hands on my lap. And that's just totally uncomfortable for me. And if I was like that, I'd be really nervous, really waiting for something. And I saw her as, you know, either going to doctors and being really nervous, or getting out and waiting for results or something, you know, and really, I don't know, I just felt a lot of tension there or something with her.
Kai?
I didn't see a doctor's office at all. I don't know, I thought it was their home.
Mm-hmm.
First I thought the woman was waiting patiently, being the best she could be for him, and he was, at first I thought it was almost like a phone book or something, and maybe they were making a reservation or calling up to see what restaurant they can go to, or
I didn't, that didn't really come out right away, but I kind of feel like, okay, what are we going to do? And she's just patiently, okay, whatever I can do you to be pleasing, you know, let me do that.
Really interesting. Darren, I think you had your hand.
Going along with what Tom said, I thought the chairs really enhanced kind of the hardness and the, I don't know, the, what was it that you were using?
I said they could be folded.
Yeah, it's all temporary stuff.
Well, no, no. Oh, just, that's what you said first. What did you say?
That's the way they're sitting with his things, like that they're nervous and tense.
Yeah, tenseness and the just kind of rigid.
Okay, Marty, I think you had your hand, and Kai wants to jump in again.
Yeah, I had it almost exactly the same as what Kai said. I thought the lady there looks really serene and really, for me, looks comfortable because she's probably been doing that all her life. And, like, she's just saying, all right, this is like it always has been. And it's like, just, this guy's going, oh, damn, I can't find what I'm looking for. And she's going, oh, dear, don't worry about it.
Marty, I wrote down the
exact
same that lady is saying, oh, dear. You know, it's okay. That's exactly what I wrote down.
Kai, did you
want to
say something?
I just wondered, is the picture just the live part at the bottom of the floor, or is it in? Because that bottom part really
bothered me. The
bottom
part is part of the painting.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That really bothered me for some reason.
Whoa.
That makes it seem more like it is in an artist's studio, that it's just a scene set apart. And it looks like he kind of used makeshift furniture, because it seems like it's an old-fashioned picture, but those are very modern chairs.
Yeah.
If you look at the chest, it's a tool chest. We have a tool chest exactly like that at home. You can lift up the bottom drawer, and the drawers get smaller on the way up, and with the wheels on the bottom.
That is precisely what it is. It is, in fact, these people were coming to the studio for a portrait, and he had them sitting and waiting before they actually thought they were going to be sitting for the portrait itself. He kind of captured this as the symbol that he wanted to use. I think it's real interesting how some of us see this in very different ways, and I think there is no right or wrong, but I think mostly we are projecting a lot of what we feel. One thing I wanted to point out that I think is the most powerful part of this piece is the woman stands alone, completely alienated from all the rest of the things going on, whereas the man overlaps the tool, has the book in his hand, has a focus, is sitting in the chair, his knee is in front of what's going on. That whole scene exists almost as if he is part of the scene and she is separate from it. And take that to mean whatever you want it to mean. To me, that's one of the most powerful parts of it. It's compositionally, sir. Christine and then Theo.
It seems like maybe that the whole thing about her standing alone, it's like she is more accepted. She's more vulnerable to me in this picture.
Good point.
Theo? Notice how she's the center of the picture. Most of the comments are about her. Ignore kind of just part of the part of the background. She looks a little more.
She looks a little more.
We're drawn more towards the feeling she portrays than the feeling he portrays.
Why do you suppose?
She's here.
Right, she's looking at us. What does it mean when someone looks at us? They're responding to us. When someone looks away, that's why John at the meeting didn't want people to be knitting. He wanted people to respond to him. That's in some ways what's happening here.
It really disturbed me because my expectation was that they would relate to each other and that they were not. That's a big thing for me in terms of the emotional feel of the picture, how distanced they were from everything.
Any other comments? Yes?
I think both this one is in that gothic form, the woman passive, the man active, and yet in the other picture, the woman looked away, the man was giving eye contact, and this one is reversed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting observation.
I also saw a deferment to him. I thought he was trying to fix something.
Mm-hmm.
and that she's just, she kind of looks like, okay, I'll let you think that, you know, you can do it, so go ahead, and I'll just sit here and wait until you give me the answer. But, I don't know, there's something about his trying to do it and not really being intelligent or something.
Do you think that that we keep thinking of women being more vulnerable because I see that hers giving, being there for him, she's doing that for him for some reason. Do you think it's because they let themselves be more vulnerable and that we could have that same thing, but then we stop ourselves when it comes to that kind of thing? Being vulnerable, is that something that you should put in front of you so you aren't vulnerable, or is it just a trait that you think that men are vulnerable, I mean, that women are vulnerable and men are not? That's
an interesting question.
Do we accept him sitting there like that? I mean, does that, I think the way she's sitting is bothering us, is the way he's sitting bothering us?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think she looks to me like she's sitting perfectly normal for a woman her age and her upbringing and her femininity that has been expressed to her all her life. And it's a very comfortable position. It's more comfortable than slouching. It's a meditative position. And in that chair she's in, how could she sit any other way and be feminine at all? And that's how she's raised to be.
I can see that as kind of a surrender. She has been told this is the way you're supposed to sit.
You sit flat, feet flat on the floor, legs together. That's the way women are taught to sit.
And so she's supposed to portray that image, and she's not supposed to portray any other, and that's what she has been taught to do in the way she's supposed to sit. And she would feel very wrong if she sat another way, and it's kind of a rule she has to, image she has to keep up, the rule she has to obey. Christine?
I think that's sort of an example of projecting what we want onto the picture. Could be that she looks so much older than him. She could be his mother, and
yeah.
He could just be the nervous son sitting there, leaping through, and her just calmly sitting there. And so she could actually possess more power in the picture.
Or they could be totally unrelated.
So I think that we kind of just project stereotypes.
Sure.
He spent a life of waiting, and she knows that's the best way to do it. If I sit somewhere, that's what I do. I just sit.
And he spent his life in action
and
is uncomfortable with
that. Nervous energy.
There's no arms on the chair. It's very straight. I can't imagine how else she could possibly sit with a dress on like that.
With a dress on.
What?
But women were taught not to cross their legs.
They were?
No, I know, like, thinking about my grandmother and stuff, she won't cross her legs because, right? You know, it's uncomfortable for her.
One last question I want to ask about it is, as you're looking at these two people and we're responding to them in certain ways, how many people have a sort of sense of almost sympathy to the man? Is there anyone who sort of has a sense of sort of wanting to reach out to the male figure in any way?
I do.
Raise your hands. I just want to see how many people. 1, 2, 3, 4. Just the 4 of us?
I'm
just
curious.
I was going to ask about the woman next. How many people felt that way about the woman? Much more of you. Very interesting.
Yeah,
that's why I was talking about
it. You know, what I see while we view this picture is this whole women's lip thing that the man, because he is, it seems almost that she's. The man, because she's. The roles as we put on here, that they're in a time where she's supposed to be subservient to him, that of course she's unhappy and because of him, and that means he is probably happier and more comfortable than she is, and he is inflicting it upon her to make, and she's under his control, and I kind of think, does that him have him in the social position having to inflict control over him, does that, what does that do inside of him?
Right.
In a way, though, she's also trying to please the viewer by looking out, whereas the man is intent on his own thing.
Maybe there's just a wall here. How does he see
that? Now, would he feel comfortable looking out?
Probably not.
He isn't looking out anyway.
He's not.
I mean, it could just be that the only magazines were there were Popular Mechanics, and she didn't want to look at it.
No, I don't think so.
It's like, man does all the thinking. He's done with anyone, and then she's lonely, and it's like she can't approach him, so she waits with patience.
He's not lonely.
Okay, Christine, then
he's
I think you probably labored over this one enough.
This is really weird, but until somebody said that he was reading a magazine, I thought that was radio. I thought that was radio.
Well, I think that's real interesting. It's another example of how we see what it is we want to see. Okay, are there any other closing statements about this guy? Yes, Kate.
Yeah, I feel we are not really sure. We don't know much about them, either of them.
So we read the symbols in our own kind of personal way as we want to. I think that there is no right or wrong. Just that this is a rich industrialist and his wife who are coming into a David Hockney studio for a portrait.
It is his wife?
Yep, that's his wife.
Ooh, I thought for sure.
She looks older primarily because of the lighting and that we see her face. Also, I think age plays differently on men than women as they get older, too. But that's who it is. And of course, a lot of this has to say something about David Hockney as well. So there's a rich kind of interplay of subject matter, artist, and observer. So another sort of filters.
Yeah, also photo, book, flowers, and mirror in the picture.
Do you want to elaborate on that, Kate?
Well, I guess that's why I thought that it was a statement on what their lives were all about, sort of remnants that were important to them. Stuff, because the people and the stuff are almost equally painted the same way with the same feeling. So everything's lovely and ordered, and everything's part of the furniture in a way.
Mm-hmm. People too.
People too. They're part of the furniture. They're furniture as well.
Yes, I saw the furniture as props instead of as furniture. Just seems so set up.
Yeah, I agree. They're probably uncomfortable because they're sitting on chairs they've never experienced before with a tool chest instead of something else that the objects are not their object. Anyway, let's bring our chairs back into the circle and we'll continue. What I hope happens ultimately is when you experience art in your own lives, you'll have a little more capacity for patience to be able to kind of respond and feel about them. And we'll look at some more art later on. I was going to show you some other things that would relate more directly to the inner-outer assignment, except that I forgot to put the slides in the carousel, and I have so many slides in my room it's impossible for me to find them in a couple minutes. So we're going to have to wait on that one until tomorrow. I'll try and bring that one tomorrow, and maybe we'll talk about one of the other metaphors for imaging. So anyway, we have another half hour left. So before I start controlling the situation, does anyone have anything they would like to talk about? In general, or about energy? Yes, Kai.
I think it's funny that when we watch them, I don't really think very much about what I'm getting out of it, usually, especially where we are. But sometimes it really frustrates me that when other people see so many of these sexual things in it that I don't think I would ever see, that I would pull out. And it's just like, I don't know, it frustrates me, bothers me.
What bothers you about it?
I don't know, that seems like like those men and women pictures, to me, I don't know, people picked up much more harsh language than I saw. I don't know, it's like you pass right by the people, the feelings, and go right to this, you know, what do they look like sexually, what's their appearance out of, I don't know.
You mean sexually like Elmore's talking about, or what?
I don't know, it's like we...
I mean, those are the comments you say?
Yeah, it's almost like I would have to be so strained to make up comments like that I can't. I mean, maybe mine sound like that too, but it frustrates me that
But what frustrates you about it? I'm trying to get down into what.
That I mean, I don't really want to see those things in it, and people pull them out like, you know, this is what all pictures are. You know, this is what I see.
So what frustrates you is you think that either they're wrong or you're wrong.
I don't know if it's wrong. I don't. Frustrates me. Yeah, I guess why they pull that out? Why that's the most important thing.
Maybe he's frustrated about sexuality being so pervasive in people, about how it is and everything. It was like relating to Elmer's talk that, you know, we don't like to admit that there is sexuality involved in things, but that it actually is involved in everything. I mean, you can't create everything because you are a man and something comes out. Maybe that's, is that something just that there's so much.
Maybe, I don't think it's something though that I see and I'm not willing to admit. I really don't feel that. I just don't feel that I see it. I see it in such a more, I would call it human feeling.
What I'm trying to ask though is that you experience one thing and others experience something else, but what frustrates you about that difference?
I guess I don't know what kind of answer. I think kind of what I felt from it. Maybe it's because I feel that so many other people see that and it makes me maybe frustrated about what society does. Maybe, I don't know, I mean, I don't really want to see those things maybe, but I don't think it helps me to point them out. I don't know.
Kate, you muttered to me that you think you know why.
It sounds to me like you're frustrated because other people see something that's different from what you see or how you interpret it, and that there's one or the other is wrong or missing or
maybe
lacking.
I feel like maybe the people pull out maybe perverted or in that maybe that sense of the sexuality kind of things out of things that don't seem maybe necessary, or maybe that I just don't. It's like why? Why
not?
So is it wrong?
Meg's got her hand up.
I think I can kind of understand what Kai's saying, because I felt like that when we were looking at one of the first days at advertising and stuff.
Me too.
And some of the stuff people said, I just don't think that way, and I find it kind of sad or whatever that society has turned it so that people, I don't know, because I can kind of understand, because I don't want to look at stuff and think that. I want to be have this, I don't know, naiveness or whatever about what advertisers or whatever really want, and I want, is this making any sense?
Well, it's making sense, but not the sense you think it is. Keep talking, Meg.
You don't want to look at things that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I think there are two issues that are being raised here that are real important. Go ahead, Tom.
Society surrounds us with all this stuff and makes us look at it, and, you know, just constantly makes us look at it. But society also tells us that it's wrong to look at it. But the whole way society works is making us look at it, but still they're telling us it's wrong. And that's what frustrates us, because when we don't see it, then we're kind of feeling like, well, I should see it because I know it's there. And when we don't see it, when we do see it, then we feel guilty because society says we shouldn't. I mean, something like
so
that.
What's the message behind that? I mean, it's a mixed message, but what basically is what you get communicated with? What communicates with that kind of message? A lack of personal empowerment, because you can't trust yourself to respond, because no matter how you trust, it's wrong. Remember when I was talking before about the advertising, and I talked about going into Nordstrom's? And what I said that advertising was designed to do? Designed to make me feel stupid, and designed to make me feel that there isn't anything I can do that was going to make me be acceptable. That's the basic premise behind advertising, is you are not a whole person. So the messages they give you are mixed to keep you from doing that. I'm not saying that someone consciously figured it out, although I'm sure some people do, but it certainly is a manifestation. Those aren't the things I wanted to talk about, though. There's two other things. I think, Theo, you had your hand up.
That's fine.
Okay, Kate, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I didn't feel that some of the sexual aspects of the picture were wrong. I enjoyed them. So I think it depends on what point of view you're coming from, too. I've looked at a lot of art, and I think my interpretation is some people put an overlay of what they're supposed to believe onto what they really see, and it blocks some of that feeling. Powerful stuff.
Or you know you're expected to see the sexual message in it, so you pull it out of it. They say, oh, here's a painting, here's a work of art. Well, let's see. First thing you do is you look for the sexual messages. Well, this could be in this, and this could be in this.
Well, I think that the struggle that we have is that we always have to keep looking in absolute terms. We're not comfortable unless we're looking in absolute terms. And there are two ways of looking at that one issue. One of them, for me, is that your response is yours. Because everybody else in the whole world has a different response doesn't mean your response is wrong or different. And so accepting that response is an important part of it. The other thing is also realizing that your response is a projection of your inner self, in which case, if it is an expression or reflection of your inner self, it's an interesting proposition to kind of look at that and compare it to what other people think. Not to judge, but to just sort of look and see. For instance, oftentimes we don't want to see anything that has any sexual implication because we're uncomfortable with it, we don't know what to do with it, we can't understand it in our own lives or fill in the other blank, and so we won't experience that part, and we'll get angry when other people experience it. The important thing is anger. When I walk into an art gallery and I get angry at the kind of art I'm seeing, I have to ask myself, what is really going on here? I can dismiss it, say it's bad art, it's someone is pulling the wool over our eyes, that someone is really getting away with something, making a lot of money for nothing, or whatever my rationale is for looking at art. But my anger tells me something important. So your frustration is telling you something important. It's not just the frustration of, oh, I have a different opinion. It's a trouble, a problem. There's something else going on about that. I don't know where that's coming from.
Do you think that all these artists, it seems like almost everything, every artist is putting things in there specially to think, I'm going to put this kind of, I wonder what's going to arouse their sexual...
Every artist puts messages in their pieces, but not always consciously. And that's the thing that we have to realize. When we look at a piece, we are responding to it ourselves. You're responding to it because we are, one, an individual, two, a member of a particular cultural context and a generational context. And so consequently, we see things. We see things that maybe the artist had in mind and maybe what they didn't have in mind. For me, one of the things that makes art wonderful is its synergistic quality, which is, I think, most art historians really miss the point when they try and talk about just symbology. Because I look at my own art and maybe there's all kinds of symbology there that I didn't know consciously that I put there. In fact, as I told you, I try purposefully not to be conscious about it. But it doesn't mean that it's not there, because I think it is. So when we see that, we can be communicated to through the artist's eyes as well as our own, but it doesn't mean that the artist had to know about it. That doesn't make it more or less valid. So the two issues then that I was trying to say is, one, you're entitled to your own personal ideal or belief, and it is yours, and it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. And two, your own personal reflection is an important tool to understanding where you're coming from in terms of how you're looking at the world. After all, art is merely another metaphor. And that's what was wonderful to experience here, when we saw very different points of view from the exact same image. And no one was right or wrong. It was just really, really neat to see that. Which is why I expect that same thing happens when we read literature, that we get a lot of different messages from the same kind of thing. Literature is easy for us to rationalize about because of the nature of language, which is very different from the nature of visualization. Visualization is more like, although not exactly, music, because it communicates to us directly. It bypasses some kind of rational thing. Anyway,
and that ties in with Omar's talk, because some people got out of it different things. And that's a reflection on where they are and who they are.
In fact, you'll get different things out of this course. 2 months from now, when you're thinking back about this course, you all got together again and said, okay, now that I've experienced it, now that I'm back in my regular life, what really did I get out of the course? Some of you would say, nothing. Some of you say, it changed my life. Some of you say, well, this was interesting, but that really wasn't. Someone would say, it was the skiing that was most important. I mean, it all depends on who you are, what you get out of it. So
some of you will say,
I
cut my beard.
So what's the purpose of the professors, you as the professor, or you as the leader, I don't know, what is your purpose in the course? But, I mean, what's your goal for it? I would think that professors, you would think that for the students, I would like them to...
You want a definite answer, it sounds like.
Yeah, I do.
Do you want to increase what we get out of more than the speed and more than the fighting? You want us to get more than that?
It's this kind of throws back to a lot of the questions that it seems that we ask a lot of questions so that we limit the self or limit ourselves, and we limit it so we can do well at whatever it is that we're trying to do. And it, the crux or the juxtaposition for me to figure out, you know, in this course, possibly we're trying to realize our limitations, not set them, or not so much realize our limitations, but accept them and then go beyond them. Not making much sense, but like I say, I see, or I kind of sense that there's a lot of these things where we want these absolute answers to limit what we can do so we can do that well, and therefore we can call ourselves good. Seems like we need to venture out from the absolute and go that which we don't know if we're going to do well or not, but rather we just do well being.
Venture into the wilderness. Chart surface. Is that what you think? That you want?
That's what I see in all of wanting.
That's interesting.
Does
it matter what we want, Theo? What if all I wanted was just to have a good time, and this is the only way I could get here to do it? Would that matter?
I'd say no.
I don't know.
I'd say yes. It really makes a difference to me that I know my teachers, that they're caring about what the things that we're thinking about and that I'm learning. If they teach me and they go, well, go ahead, learn the stuff, but, you know, just don't get me in trouble for being doing my course. Then I can't learn half as well from those people.
What if I said, you know, everything I've said in this class is bullshit? Everything I said is a lie.
I wouldn't believe you.
But anyway, what if that's what I really felt? What if that's what I really...
Or that you could care less.
Or that I could care less. Tom, you have your hand up higher and higher.
Right. Well, you could just be like Chauncey Gardner. I mean, what you could be saying, you could be talking about something totally different than what we're hearing, but we could still gain so much from that. I mean, we're just letting you be what we need you to be, and so it really doesn't really matter. I mean, you may decide that instead of taking the boat, you want to walk back to Chelan on the lake, but as long as... You know, and in that sense, you know, somebody raised a question, or maybe it was on the back of the book or something, about Chauncey Gardner being a messiah of some sort, and that's, you know, maybe he was. He made an old man in his last days happy and content. He gave something to a woman. He gave something to the whole nation that they needed. Everything was different. And the whole time he was just talking about a garden, that's all he wanted. But still, everybody got something out of it. So it really doesn't matter what you say, or if you say that you're only talking about something totally different, because we're not going to believe you anyway. We're just going to take what we want it to mean. So.
Hey, Christine, did you have your hand up?
No, I was just going to draw a parallel because I remember you said something in class yesterday about, like, if you went to a psychologist, you know, and they told you one thing, then you turned out they were lying or something like that. It was just interesting. It's irrelevant because I can't remember what I'm trying to
do. It gets back to my whole idea of heroes. If you have your personal experience and you learn from it, does it matter if your hero actually turns out to be something other than what you expected? Does it matter if we really believe anything that we say? You still have the opportunity to make a personal belief, like Tom is saying. You can still get all that you need out of it. That's why, in a way, Theo, I would want to answer that question. Although you probably know the answer anyway. It's like, it doesn't matter, or it shouldn't matter. That's the struggle we have. That's part of the wilderness, part of the whole thing, is struggling with the idea of authority and needing someone to show us the way. Whether it's God, or whether it's our parents, or whether it's our teachers, or whether it's our companions. Whether it's a community, fill in your own blank. What's the words of that song where our prison is walking through this world all alone? Interesting point.
speaking of prisons and walking through the world all alone, I'd like to get back to Narcissus and Golden. And toward the, what do you think is happening with, I want to get through the end of Goldman's journey and try and put lay some groundwork so that we can maybe tomorrow finish up the book and talk about Goldman's return. But what's happening to Goldman at the end of his journey, his sort of last escapade stuff? What do you sense is going on? Sorry to shift gears so quickly, but I'd like to get this part done in the next 15 minutes. Go ahead, Pat.
He still, I think, thinks Narcissus as a superior in a certain way. He respects his opinion in some things almost more than his own, or he needs that acceptance to an extent that he has to leave to find that out, to get away from that.
Were you talking about before he returned the first time? I mean, after he's been imprisoned, or are you talking about the very final one where he brick falls off the floor and breaks?
No, I'm not talking about the final one. But that's a slightly different issue. But I'm talking about when he's saved in jail from Narcissus. What happens?
Back to the bishop's city.
Pardon me?
He goes back to the bishop's city?
Yeah. What's going on with him? I mean, he starts thinking about some of the stuff differently. What's the difference in the way Narcissus experiences his second visit to the city than the first visit to the city? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I think maybe he had more attachment, and when he found out that the master wasn't there anymore, I mean, that the master was dead, and that, I mean, the whole thing's changed. I mean, the girl is not that, I don't know, pleasant or whatever anymore. She's here wearing this dark dress, and when he's locked up, then it's just, it's not the happy whatever place that he knew it as.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't, when he first went there, he was excited and happy, and everything seemed to be, if things did go wrong, they would get better soon, was his attitude. He was very optimistic. And then the second time, he was very depressed, and he was looking for the security of the master. And he didn't see it there. He's kind of searching for something. Before he did search for the master, had a goal, but he didn't have a goal this time. He was just searching. Or maybe he did more of that security.
He had all these images in him, and he'd been taking in all these experiences. I think he finally reached a point where he felt he needed to let them out. And the knowledge that he could go back to the master and let those out kind of got him going again. But then when he got there, found the master dead, then he kind of felt really bad again because he couldn't let him out. And then it made him feel a little bit better that he could sketch them on that sketch pad. But I still think that he was so full of experiences that he finally just wanted to let some of them out.
How does this relate to the conversation you were just having about teachers and whether they believe it or not in terms of what Golden experienced there? Goldman came back to this place wanting to be able to express himself. He was even thinking about maybe he was going to be that apprentice, maybe he could sort of find this woman again, find the master again. He even sort of implied that maybe he could take what the master was going to offer him once before. He gets there and he doesn't have that. She is a different person, he is dead, the workshop is closed, and he is sort of doesn't have the answer waiting for him that he expected. His teacher is not there, his inner master has changed. He no longer seems to be able to express himself because someone doesn't give him the power or authority to do it. And he is really thrown for a loop, not really knowing what to do. All he has left then, after his bouts of depression and joy, is back to the sensual side of himself, the expressive side that having to do with women again, which is ultimately what leads him to this situation where he is almost dies, a situation he knew would happen, a situation he understood full well the risks of. I think the whole idea of teacher or master related to how that empowers us to express ourselves is a real important lesson to what Goldman experiences at that one point. You understand what I'm saying? Can you see the association there?
No.
Can anyone see the association that I'm making? What happens to Goldman when he's there in the city, for me, is that he's there, he's experiencing, he's getting all this neat stuff, he womanizes, he has brawls, he makes great art, he impresses the master, he's given the opportunity to go into the guild, he realizes that it's not what he wants, he really needs to kind of continue traveling, he's empowered as a person to be what he is, what he wants to be, he is himself. He goes out, he experiences death, he understands what it's like to help somebody else transit that world, he sees a lot more of the world, and suddenly he's ready to go back now and make that art again, and suddenly he is not given the opportunity. He cannot go back to his old world in order to express it, and he feels that he cannot express himself then. The sketches that he makes in his room, he realizes they're kind of neat, but he doesn't feel about it. He still can't express the inner part. He needed the master. He needed the master's daughter. He needed that in order to find himself. He needed his teacher to empower him with the opportunity to be able to do it. When he doesn't get that, he's thrown for a loop.
So you're saying he was cast back upon himself.
Exactly.
And he couldn't go back home.
So what does he do? How does he respond to that? He responds to that by...
He's the only part of himself that he can, you know, he has confidence in him that, you know, he can give him power, and that's his sexual side. Right.
And what does that now play out? Before, he was fairly cautious and safe. Now it seems that he's taking more risks. He's putting himself in a position that is increasingly likely to lead to some very intensified experience, possibly even death. Yes?
Is this a crying out type of, you know, a lot of people, you know, will go to the ultimate, you know, they'll keep going along and then they'll...
Yeah, I think sort of that's what he's saying. I think he's crying out for help like we all cry out for help to ourselves about our behavior. What's happening is that, in fact, we talked about this before in terms of ritual and habit, that his sensual side is now habitual. It's no longer feeding him like it used to feed him. He's no longer growing from it. It's his way of experiencing the world. It is not enlivening anymore. It is not enriching to him. So he takes increasing risks, thinking that, oh, what I need to do is to escalate the nature of the experience, keeping him closer and closer to the edge. In which case, what happens, of course it's a metaphor, but what happens is that he is ready to be executed and to save the last moment by his past. A part of his past, the part of his past that he has maybe been denying or running away from most of his life. The metaphor there for me is that through realizing that he has no external teacher to go to, that he must find his own way, he struggles with the way, sort of in an increasingly almost damaging, risk-taking manner, finds that part of himself, mysteriously, miraculously meets up with that part of himself that he's been denying all this time. And if you follow that train of thought throughout, it's in the cloister again where he finally can accept himself, accept his own death, accept the fact that nobody is really better than he is. And do you see that kind of thought as it sort of plays out throughout that book? Tom?
In a way, first he accepted Narcissus as his teacher, his idol, following anything that he did or said, and then he totally switched to a new teacher, the world, and experienced everything it did without questioning. You know, and finally he finds himself as his own teacher in a way.
Yeah, I think that's really primarily what happens to him. That he, several times you can see where he does things habitually, and something happens, even when he's in the knight's house. I remember when I read that book the first time, and I kept saying, what are you doing with both of them? My God, you're really going to get it. You've got a really neat thing going over there. What are you going to do? You're going to mess it all up. He's going to kill you. He's going to do something horrible to you. And nonetheless, he kind of continues with that risk flowing with it, and the habitualness of staying in the knight's room changes. He's thrown out into the world again. He's constantly being thrown out into the world. He constantly chooses that road, and he constantly grows from it until he gets to a certain point. It no longer is, it's not exactly what it was for him before, from my point of view.
Okay. going along the lines of all that visualness that when he was in the dungeon waiting for the execution, he was finding a way out by killing the monk and escaping. That was another thing that could have been happened, but would not, would continue just kind of bumbling along and not going to.
Yeah, just based on what you're saying, Todd, I just suddenly thought about my own personal situation and the way the messages that I was raised with, my parents no longer believe in. The messages that society raised me in, society no longer believes in. So I'm walking around realizing I can never go back home to that way that I was supposed to be. So here I am sometimes acting out these old messages where nobody else has them. And so I've had to be cast back upon myself and decide which aspects to drop,
yeah,
which bundles to leave on the railroad track.
That's also, it seemed, maybe tying it, maybe not, it seemed that several points along the line where Goldman thought he had it all figured out, and that, you know, there was nowhere else to go. But then again, something upset him, so he realized, no, he hadn't experienced, or he hadn't figured it all out, it all was.
It's like Narcissus when he was talking about peace, about finding peace over and over again. You know, you always think you have peace, and something's gonna, you know, edge, and you realize that you don't have it. So it's always, it's like a process. Like what you're saying is you're always, I mean, you'll reach it, but you'll always realize that there's probably something else that you can still, you know, like improve yourself.
But if you think you have peace, and then you find a way to get peaceful, that doesn't mean that you want peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not denying what you experience. But
just do it.
Okay. There was an issue there that I wanted to raise, but I can't think of it right now. I think I feel like this line of thought that I think is real important to the book is not real clear to you guys.
I think when you said that about how he finds he has no external teacher, that he must find his own way, and he's forced to meet up with that part of himself, which happens to be narcissistic in the book, that he has been denying for so long. I mean, when you said that, is that what you're trying to get to?
That's part of it, yeah. Yeah. And wait, anyway, go ahead, Connie.
Maybe it's because it relates to me. He feels really confident to me of any new experience. He's not scared of anything that's new. He knows that he can befriend strangers, but he somehow closes things behind him, which really looks uncomfortable to me, because if I go out there to where I try to leave everything open behind me too. And I don't know if that, we talked about that suicide thing yesterday, but I don't understand it really. And so he can continue to keep on going. He never really goes to the same place, it seems like. He always keeps going further and further away, or on this kind of straight, jagged line, but it doesn't really cross. That maybe he's afraid to just look where he is, or to go back to people that he already knows, that he would have a harder time relating to people that already know.
Interesting.
See, I didn't think he befriended anyone. I think everyone except Narcissus, which was really a part of himself, was just an experience, something outside himself that might have maybe done something inside, but it was just something outside him, like he was using everybody to learn from, but I don't really see that he prevented anyone except Narcissus. And the only reason he defended Narcissus is because Narcissus was part of himself.
I think that's a good point in there. Burned his bridges behind him all the time.
We're going to talk more about this tomorrow, right?
Yeah, we're going to talk about which one we identified with and why. We're going to talk about the close of the book and the reunification at the end, and what is the big heavy duty thing that Goldman says to Narcissus and why it stabs him to the heart.
And also see some slides.
We may have time for some slides. I hope so. I hope so. Keep it brief though.
If anyone wants to read this book, it's available. And there is a 2-page summary of the author. Very fascinating guy. So if you're curious about what you saw last night, the book's really good.
Book written from the movie, or is
it the movie is made from the book?
With author Jewish.
Kaczynski is, gosh, was he Jewish?
Polish.
Polish. He's Polish, but he might have been Jewish.
Holocaust victim.
Good chance.
I thought it was interesting last night in the movie how my stereotype of a Jewish older gentleman, like him, and I thought that was just really interesting that I picked it up.
Peter Sellers?
Yeah,
Peter Sellers is Jewish, so maybe that.
Well, maybe that has something to do with it, but I just, like, stereotype, I think.
Which I think is consistent with the Christ allegory, too.
Yeah.
What they say about him is he writes his novels so sparsely as though they cost $1,000 a word, and a misplaced or misused locution would cost him his life. It takes 3 years to write a novel.